Well, one of the advantages of preaching through a long sermon series like Mark is practically we're not spending a lot of time in the next couple weeks thinking, what am I going to preach on? I know some guys, they decide what to preach on Tuesday, or at least they start thinking about it on Tuesday. I honestly couldn't live like that. It'd be so draining. But one of the other reasons we chose, so part of we picked Mark is with all this other pastoral staffing transition, it's just simpler to kind of be able to go through a book together. But one of the other reasons is when you work through a book chronologically, you're going to come across topics like I would not personally think to preach on. And maybe, honestly, you sitting there, I don't know how many of you woke up this morning and said, oh, goody, I hope Pastor Enoch preaches on demon possession, because I was just wondering about that the other day. Years back at this church, we were preaching through the Gospel of Matthew in one of the settings we have, one of the ministries. And honestly, I probably spent 2 sermons on baptism, like about baptism proper, what it actually is, more than I probably would ever feel the need to preach on. In the last few months, some of you, both here and at Chinatown campus, have shared about work challenges, life challenges, health challenges, relocation. There's just so much going on. And as every time I hear you guys pour out your hearts, whether it's in passing in the hallway or at a meal or at a counseling session in an office, I think, oh, there's so much rich hope that the Word of God gives you. Of course, that's for sermons, not necessarily for a counseling pastoral care session to, like, you know, give you a 30-minute spiel. And so that's kind of the stuff that is going in my mind. And of course, that just means that after the Gospel of Mark, Lord willing, there's mounds and mounds of great sermon topics and ideas that we can study together. But I remember preaching on baptism, and I remember thinking, okay, Lord, I don't think anyone's really asking about this. Our non-Christian friends in the community are not asking. Our Christian friends are not really asking. And so, but, you know, trying to be faithful, so we preached on it. And God humbled me and reminded me that He has a plan. He wrote the Bible. He wrote the books. And when we go through the Bible chronologically, sometimes we'll do topically or thematically or study a character. Right now we're going through the Bible, through the Gospel. You're going to come across passages you wouldn't pick on. And actually, it was after that sermon series, actually not even a series, a couple sermons on baptism that, you know, when the next baptism cycle came and I'm interviewing people who are applying, and I would always ask them, what makes you want to get baptized now? Did you become a Christian recently? Or if you've been a Christian, what makes you want to get baptized now? And more people than I thought, which is at least one, okay, was like, actually, I was convicted by the passage we studied a few months ago. You remember what? That's amazing. So we're at this point. I don't know how many of you are praying to God, please, can one of the pastors preach on demon possession? Because I was trying to find a Wikipedia article and I couldn't find it. Actually, there's one there if you want to know, I think. But so here we come to this very interesting passage. And we're here in Boston, Metro Boston. Maybe you've been in church for a while. Maybe you've been coming to BCC. And now you might have a different impression. Is this church, with all the smart people they have in it, like, are they really going to believe that these demons exist? And so I believe this passage is part of 3 stories that Mark, the author, is telling about the story of life of Jesus, about Jesus' supreme power. Previously, last week, Pastor Steve, along with his son Matt, shared about Jesus' supreme power over nature and storms. And actually, storms in nature often were seen as associated with dark and evil forces. Next week, Lord willing, as we continue in Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 and so forth, there might be the familiar to some of you story of Jesus healing the bleeding woman and resurrecting the daughter of Jairus. So we're going to talk about that. That's the plan next week. And so there you have Jesus' supreme power over disease and death. And here there's a power in the mindset of the ancient reader and audience of Jesus that was humongous. It's bigger than what Wall Street symbolizes in terms of the business corporate world, bigger than the government symbolizes. It was a humongous power thing. And the gospel writer intentionally wanted us to understand that Jesus is supreme even over that, and that is, yes, demonic forces and powers. But today, in 2017, you might be thinking, I know some of us, we have been on missions or we know missionaries, and I know there are many parts of the world that believe heavily in the demonic and the occult and that stuff, but what about us here? Has it really happened here? And even, yes, in Boston and Newton, I've seen demonizations where it seems really, the best explanation really is there's some sort of evil spirits going around. But for some of us, that's a big hurdle, intellectually and practically. So this morning into afternoon, 4 points from the pastors that I believe God has for us this morning. And they are this. First of all, that we need to believe the demonic powers are real. We need to believe, yes, I'm saying this, and I did go to college, that demonic powers are real. Which then leads to point 2. How do we discern? How do we tell if demonic powers are actually at work in our lives? Is it smoke? Is it floating above the ground and in red blinking lights? I mean, how can we actually tell in this very modern age that demonic power is actually working? Thirdly, we're going to see, mainly, how does Jesus defeat demonic powers and evil? And then fourthly, briefly, we'll touch upon it, but it's in the text, so what do we do about it? So again, 4 points. First of all, that we need to believe that demonic powers are real and very active in our lives, in our world, right now in modern-day Boston and Newton and the Metro Boston area. Secondly, how do we tell in this modern-day setting that actually demons, I mean, are they really there? How can we tell? Thirdly, how does Jesus defeat demonic powers of evil? And then fourthly, what do you and I do about it? Whether we're Christians or non-Christians, young or old. So, first of all, if you've been paying attention, this point, I already told you the point. I didn't pose it as a question. Now, points 2 to 4, I haven't told you the points. I've told you the question the point addresses. But this is the point, that we need to believe that demonic forces and powers are real before we believe Jesus has power over them. Demonic forces and powers are very real, and we might think it's odd today, but they're here. And so let's take a look as we come back to the chapter 5. Would you turn back to the Bibles and follow along with me in Mark chapter 5. I'm going to see this. They came to the other side of the area, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. There is actually demonic oppression. This is a scene where Jesus has gotten into the boat, coming from the Jewish sort of side, coming out to the eastern side of the sea or Lake of Galilee, and he comes here, and it's probably a non-Jewish Gentile side because of the presence of pigs. And there's a man with unclean spirit, and some translations, including this one, have the words demon-possessed. But really the best word that most scholars tell us is helpful is it's not actually possession. Now, there are ways in which you are possessed. Interestingly, the only person that possesses a Christian is God. God possesses. We're his possession if we're believers. And so it's not about demon possession, but a word that many of these scholars can help us think is demonization. To the degree which a demon is interacting in your life. And we need to understand that according to the Bible, yes, demons are very much real. Now, a couple questions. First of all, I mean, seriously? Is it logical to believe in supernatural demons? I mean, are we talking about red color, skin tone, sort of horned, you know, smoke coming out of their nostrils, little hobbling goblin men walking around? Is that what we're talking about? Well, it could be part of that. The gospel also tells us that angels can, demons can be disguised as agents of light, being very beautiful or pretty. But the key thing here is that, let's look. If there's a belief in God, and he's a supernatural being or non-material, non-physical being, and we believe that there's a realm beyond just the mere physical, which I know it's not everyone believes. But if you do believe in God, and it's not a big stretch to go from God, well, if there's God, there's other beings in the supernatural realm, angels, then it stands to reason it's completely logical that there would be forces in the supernatural realm that are not only good, but also evil. They are not the opposite of God. God can't have an opposite. It's not a yin-yang. There is no equal opposing force to Almighty God. But he did create a host of angels, and some of those angels have turned and rebelled against him, chief among them Lucifer or Satan, and others have kind of lined up behind Satan as fallen angels. So the Bible teaches us that, and there's not a lot of data on angels and demons in the Bible, but it's pretty clear that demons are fallen angels, basically. And so it's logically not that big a stretch to actually understand that, well, if there's a God, wow, there's so many of you up there. Hi, I didn't see that. In the coming weeks, I would invite you all to come down. That is possible, that's totally logical. Well, so it's pretty logical that there's God, there's Jesus rose from the dead, that angels and demons, it makes sense. But then it comes to this other question that maybe modern people have, which is, didn't we use like angels and demons and spirits to explain things that we didn't understand? But now with science, hey, you know, we should think there's a spirit involved in the rain. That's why it did or didn't rain when we wanted it to. But now we understand it's low pressure, high pressure, it's moisture in the atmosphere. Or, you know, wasn't it because we didn't understand how, like, you know, the plants grew, so we thought, oh, the spirits help the harvest and things, but now we understand, no, we understand biology, microbiology a lot better. Or isn't it like like, oh, didn't the spirits have this generational curse in your family so that you have some condition and your ancestors have some condition, your children have some conditions. But now we have better understanding of genetics, and so we don't really need spirits anymore, isn't that right? And philosophers call this the God of the Gaps theory, because as science and knowledge increases, God's domain gets smaller and smaller because we don't need him anymore. And so a lot of people, Christians even, or people who would claim to be Christians, would also say, you know, kind of simplistic worldview. Well, actually, I would challenge that. The Bible would challenge that. Way back thousands of years ago in the life of Jesus, in the Gospel of Matthew chapter 4, verse 24, we read the writer Matthew describing the biography of Jesus, saying that Jesus healed many who were demon-possessed, he healed many who were ill, and healed many who were considered lunatics or struggling with lunacy. That word is kind of negative if you call someone a lunatic today, and it's sort of modern origins. It's like they thought that people became crazy with the moon, hence the word lunar, lunacy. But really, in the context of Jesus, it meant that there are people with sort of these mental issues. Okay, why is that important? Because thousands of years ago, the Bible, the biblical worldview, that Jesus is teaching, the followers of Jesus understood that when you and I have are afflicted with problems, it's not so simple. It could be physiological, which therefore you need rest or help or medicine or something medical. It could be psychological, okay, which could be trauma or post-traumatic stress, things like that. Or it could even be spiritual or supernatural. And I want to challenge you, what is more simplistic? To assume everything has a natural cause? To assume everything has a natural, materialistic explanation? You're not feeling well. There must be something wrong with you. Well, do more tests, do more studies, and take a pill. That's sort of the naturalistic, physicalist way. Or, you're something's wrong with you? Maybe you just got to talk it out more. Got to center yourself. You got to just accept who you are, be okay with that. That's really the heart of all things. That's pretty simplistic, that everything is about accepting who you are. That's called Disneyland. That's called that kind of modern, we like that in movies and stuff. That's about being who you are. And then, there's this other one where everything is spiritual. Everything is a demon. Everything is that. Jesus, thousands of years ago, his followers had already understood the clear differentiation that when you have a problem, it's showing up in your life, maybe some manifestations, physically or emotionally, whatever it is. The Bible's worldview is this. You know, your problem could be physiological. Maybe get rest. Maybe drink or eat better, okay? It could be conscience. It could be guilt. You could be feeling really bad. And it's eating away at your conscience and your soul. It could be psychological, traumatic, or mental. But never discount the possibility that it could also be spiritual. And that's really what this is all about here. And that's a huge, powerful source of the challenges. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 6, there's a part where Paul is teaching about leaders of the church. And he says this, the leaders of the church should not be new converts, newly converted people. Why? Because, well, if you just became a Christian, or just joined the church, and then you're like thrust into the super high leadership, he says you might become puffed up and proud, and fall into the ensnarement of the devil. So when we talk about problems in people's lives, the Bible's worldview is really multidimensional. It's intertwined. It shows that even in that one little, almost like cast-aside example, that your temptations, my temptations, can lead us to sort of the demonic powers tempting us and becoming ensnared, which could lead us to psychological or physiological issues, which could lead to real traumatic mental issues. It's all there. And the wise biblical counselor, the wise person says, look, you've got this problem, you're coming to me, you share with your mentor, you're talking to your small group, you're pouring your heart to another couple, and maybe in your TLC group or something. And the wise person says, okay, let's check out the physiological. Have you seen a doctor? How's your diet and eating? You at least rule out any of those things. And we don't assume you're struggling because of sin, but is it worthwhile for all of us to humbly check, is there some unconfessed sin in my life? Is there something I'm holding against someone? And examine under the power of the Spirit. It's worth making sure that we don't have any psychological or mental issues, but don't forget the fact that it could be separate or also supernatural and spiritual and demonic. That's the biblical multidimensional worldview. It's not simplistic. Anyone who says the Bible's simple, like, has not read the life of Jesus carefully enough yet. And so demonic powers are still working. Which then maybe go like this. Well, if they're really working, I mean in Newton, I mean like in Waltham, I mean Framingham, I mean like wherever we live, Brookline, whatever it is, what does it look like? I mean, yeah, there are stories from missionaries of like people like, you know, saying and talking strange things and just violent thrashing like in the story. And they do happen here, a place like North America, but it seems very few. So while I do not discount that that happens, for the most part, a lot of us, we still ask, what does it look like? What does demonic powers in your life today look like? And actually, it's quite scary when you think about it. So I'm going to suggest that as we move to point two, how to tell or what to do, how to discern if demonic forces are working, I'm going to tell you what I think are sort of the three features this passage shows that if they're all present, it may be demonic. I'm going to list them to you and then show you them from the text. I'm going to tell you, first of all, demonic forces may be working in your life when you have more strength or ability, maybe even more than you think you should. Not only do you have more strength or ability, that strength, that very same thing that maybe you're really good at, maybe you have some power in, maybe that even gives you success, actually down the road becomes something that enslaves you. Okay? So that thing that gives you power but also potentially enslaves you, should you try to give it up, people look at you and think you're stupid. They think it's crazy that you would give it up. We see this in the life of the demoniac or the demonized man as we come here. Let's turn our attention back to the scripture. Let's pick it up here in verse 3. This man, he lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains. But he wrenched the chains apart, and he broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. So this guy's strong. We know from the text that they were no longer able to bind him. So we don't know for sure, but it seems at the very least, this strength came gradually. Maybe in the beginning it was useful. Maybe he impressed the ladies with it. Maybe he used it in the agrarian society to help farm. But eventually, for whatever reason, we don't know, because it's not vital to the author's point, apparently people thought it was worth chaining this guy up. Maybe he scared the kids. Maybe they were fearful for themselves. Maybe he was a threat to himself. And they tried to chain him. And maybe in the beginning it worked. But over time he could not bind. He was just too strong. But that very strength would become his undoing and his enslavement. Verse 5. Night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." Now this guy, he's clearly, this strength is not a blessing. It's like now a curse. The demons in his life, it's just, he's totally out of control. He's at their slave's mercy. He's living in the tombs. He can't be with his family. And you would think, wouldn't you, that if somehow he was healed of that, that people would be happy. I mean, they chained the guy up. But if he gets healed, they don't need to chain him. He was living in the tombs. Maybe they were scared to have him at home. But if he gets healed, he can go home. You would think everyone would be happy. But actually, they're not happy. They're actually quite scared. They're quite frightened. They're quite freaked out. So if we go back in verse 14, go down and we'll see the response of the people. The herdsmen, the people that saw the pigs that were destroyed, fled and told it in the city and in the country. And people came to see what it was that had happened. Now get this. They came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed, formerly demonized man, the one who had the legion sitting there, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. They were afraid. Continue. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs, and they began to beg Jesus to depart from their region. So this totally scared them. So what does this mean? And let me try to put it this way. I would suggest from this text that demonic forces don't always manifest in the form of, I don't know, smoke coming out of their nostrils and strange voices and things. Though, honestly, I think that could happen. Maybe not the smoke part. That's not in the Bible. But here's what I would suggest. When you have an additional ability or gifting or strength, maybe it's just a little bit more than you would expect, more than average, more than your gene pool, more than your community would expect, or maybe it's outstanding and truly remarkable, and you lean into that, and becomes your identity, becomes really a part of who you are, so much to the point that that very ability or gift begins to ensnare you. You realize you're enslaved to it. And if you try to give it up, people would be against you giving it up. I would give the greater details another time, but three people, the exact same story. A young lady who's a violinist, a young man who is a baseball player, and another gentleman who is a brilliant lawyer. they all have the same story. They're all interchangeable. I just picked three types of abilities or strengths that you could see. In the case with the lady, the young lady, basically she was a brilliant violinist. I mean like virtuoso, like genius. The guy, the baseball player, was an incredible athlete, just all-around athlete, but just remarkable skill. And really, you know, the colleges are trying to recruit him. They have a great eye on this guy, you know. And this person who would eventually be a lawyer, just brilliant, brilliant at school. And you know what that gave to all of them when they were in high school? It gave them the currency of power in high school, which in many cases is popularity. People like them. People want to be like them. People think they're cool. And that currency, when they got to the college or university scenes, become achievement and prowess. And to the degree that they kind of went out and took on their gifts, the violinist to the baseball player and the lawyer, they became mighty in their field. But all of them began to have things show up in different seasons of their life. Their violinist in the studying in the school years, basically each of them the same story, where they were so driven to succeed in their field that they began to realize it was destroying their lives. Practicing so much, and when she no longer sort of succeeding in her auditions and getting all the gigs she was hoping for, making into the orchestras and ensembles, she began to push people away. She began to kind of like be angry. And this guy, because he had got an injury, he couldn't quite proceed with his athletic career and dreams. It crushed him. He was totally depressed. And the person who became a lawyer would eventually just ruin their family. We have this totally unhelpful phrase that pop psychology, whoa, you've always wondered if I'll fall. That pop psychology, tell me you've always wondered. He moves too close to make me nervous. That pop psychology uses and is helpful on the surface, but totally unhelpful when you think about it. And that phrase is something maybe you can relate to or you've used in conversation. And that's being a workaholic. Being a workaholic suggests that the problem is working too much. Workaholism is not the problem. It's the symptom. It's not the root issue. Now, there'll be a number of reasons why someone may work too hard, but in each of these cases, their abilities, the very things that they had, that were seen strengths and gifts, they formed their identity around, became the very things that enslaved them, began to ruin their health, their lives, their relationships, their marriage, and yes, even their spiritual lives, not because those things are bad, but because they were enslaved to them. And then, in each of these cases, these three true stories, when they would renounce them or try to give them up, do you know what some of their Christian parents said? That's a waste. You're going to give up your... What kind of stewardship? I mean, Jesus calls us to be stewards. You've got this great gift. What a waste. You went to school. What a waste. And people were like, the Christians in their circles, when they tell me about, yeah, I think I should give up violin or I'm going to change job, go back to school for something, Christians, parents are like, are you sure? I don't know if God's really telling you to waste that gift, that opportunity, that bad stewardship. And when we probed and talked about what their Christian friends, and these guys didn't know each other. They don't know that I would share them all in the same sermon. But when their non-Christian friends would find out about that, they also similarly, well, that's kind of stupid, kind of a waste. And to the degree that these people shared that it was sort of Jesus guiding them, that he was maybe releasing them from this sort of this bondage of this incredible strength or gift, the non-Christians are like, well, if that's the case, that's kind of weird. I don't know if I like that Jesus. Like, I thought, isn't this your point in life? You're a great student. You're a great athlete. You're a great singer. If we allow for the fact that Satan doesn't care whether you give him credit or not, that they don't want to take credit, they want to take you down. As C.S. Lewis in the preface of his book, The Screwtape Letters, writes about sort of devils in the modern day, he says, you know, sometimes people are overemphasize the devil. They think everything's about the devil. They think Satan made them do everything. And sometimes people ignore the devil or don't even believe him. And basically Lewis says, either way the devil's happy, as long as he can ruin our lives and cause havoc in our world. If it's the case that sometimes what it means is you have this unusual gift or this ability and you're leaning into it to the point where it begins to, you realize you're enslaved, you can't get out, and you try to get out but you can't, and people would be freaked out if you try to get out, then maybe, friends, there's a lot more demonic forces working in your life right now. One scholar noted that I didn't mention in Chinatown that Jesus gave the request to the demon. Right? The demon wanted to be cast the pigs. He said, okay. And this man later said, can I go with you? Jesus rejected him. He said, no, you can't go with me. Jesus saying yes to the demon doesn't mean that demon was right. And Jesus saying no to the man does not mean the man was wrong. which is to say some of the things that you think are great gifts from God could be from God, or it could be things that demonic forces are just happy to bless you with. Satan wants to make you rich too. Have you ever never thought that? Satan wants to give you success in this world. There's no need to turn to God. Satan wants to give you all that. He either give you all that so you don't have to turn to God, or rip it all away so you won't turn to God. If that's the case, then are demonic forces working way more in your life, life of your family, your marriage, your kids? I think so. Which leads us to, man, if that's true, it's all around us. Now, I'm not trying to say you're playing basketball and someone makes a basket. You go, nice shot, demon. I mean, that's not what we're saying. We are saying that the wise person who understands the teaching of Jesus says he could have made that shot because he's practiced. He could have made a shot because he got lucky. Or he could make that shot because, honestly, Satan has an agenda for him to become a really good player and to wrap his identity around that sport and for people to see that. And that one day will affect their decisions and their lifestyle and their family and their health. If that's the case, how does Jesus defeat that? I mean, this is an affair that's all around us now. And we see how Jesus defeats it in a very profound way. Please take a look now. How does Jesus defeat the demonic forces of darkness? Let's pick it up here in verse 6. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Verse 11. Now a great herd of pigs were feeding there on the hillside. And they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs. Send us to the pigs. Let us enter them." So he gave them permission. So again, let's just think about this. I don't know if this is the first time you read this passage, but I remember as a little kid reading this. You know, wow, this demon-possessed man does all these. And I remember as a little kid, you know, I don't know about cutting. It wasn't a commonly understood thing back then. You know, people cutting themselves and screaming. So I'm like 5 years old reading about this guy that's screaming, can't be bound, can't be contained, and cutting himself stones. It's like freaking out. And then for the first time in my life, because I know there are TV shows named Legion and stuff, that I know there's like characters in comics, but the first time in my life reading, "Who are you?" "We are Legion, for we are many." I mean, it was just before movies, but I can imagine, like, you know, like, "We are Legion." Like, these thousands of voices. It's, like, really frightening. And then to think, again, these pigs. What happens to these pigs? They're begging, "Please tend us to the pigs." And so, pick it up here in verse 13. So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs. And the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. And modern people in Boston go, "Oh, those poor piggies." That's not the point of the story. They were not sentimentally attached to these animals. It was, if anything, a destruction of vast wealth. That's what they saw going down. And the whole point of this, the whole story, this is, I can't do the justice of describing it to you, but just imagine, like, thousands of animals over there. And I don't know if you've seen a pig recently. I mean, not your friend that doesn't stop eating. But, like, you know, a real pig, they're massive creatures. And they're very loud. And just imagine if, you know, a legion. Scholars tell that maybe at the time of Jesus, a legion had about 3,500 maybe soldiers, infantry in the Roman legions. And at its peak, a legion might have had about 8,000. Some people think around this time, maybe 5,000 to 6,000. The point is, thousands of demons, thousands of individual spirits going into a herd about 2,000. I don't know, it's a couple of demons per pig. Just imagine the writhing, the just deafening sound of animals. Like, totally, I don't know if you've ever seen an animal freaked out, like a dog or rabbit cornered, just like the noises they make, the shock of their hugely opened eyes, just the freakiness of that, multiplied by 2,000, stampeding down this hillside, just destroying everything in its path, going over the cliff, plunging into the sea in a violent rashing of like bubbles and foam and death, and just until they're all just destroyed. This is pretty scary, okay? And this is all that happens. And this is to say that as strong as this man was, because Mark points out three times they could not bind him, all Jesus has to do is say the word, and they go to the pigs and they're destroyed. Now, what is important to understand is that Jesus didn't say, I just make you disappear. He can physically heal. Oftentimes, the most miraculous sort of seeming like no cost to it is when Jesus heals people. But when it comes to demons in here, this is the longest case of an exorcism we have in the New Testament that I'm aware of. And in this case, how does Jesus defeat the evil? He displaces their destructive power on something else. That thing that just wrecked, as the kids say, that just wrecked that herd of pigs, was in that man. And all the destructive, just murderous power, evil power that happened, was in this guy. And they thought, and they were scared, and it shows that how does Jesus defeat evil and the demonic powers of evil? He displaces their destructive power. Pastor Daniel, one of our pastors in our church, if you go to enough funerals with him, he kind of uses a story in several cases, so I might have ruined, you know, these sermons of his, but don't tell him. But anyway, he just tells a story of a little boy with walking with his dad in sort of this woodsy hiking thing I picture. And this boy's happily walking with their dad in sort of the foresty thing. And the boy screams out, "Daddy, Daddy, I'm scared." And he says, "Why?" "Because there's this bee. I'm scared it's going to sting me." You know, maybe he's never been stung. He's allergic. He's just really scared. And dad says, "Oh, it's okay, son. Calm down." And then kind of covers the kid. And then the kid hears the bee, then doesn't hear the bee. And then he hears the bee kind of fly away, and the dad says, "Son, that bee won't bother you anymore." "So how do you know, Daddy?" "Because the bee can't come back." "Well, how do you know, Daddy?" And so the father, as Pastor Daniel tells the story in my broken Cantonese, he takes his hand and shows his little son that the stinger is in his hand. "So the reason why, son, that bee can't get you anymore is because I've absorbed the sting. It can't hurt you anymore." As we think of the gospel, and that this is a scene in which Mark tells us of a man who has run out of the town to the tombs to have his flesh being naked and cut. That the big picture of Mark's gospel is that later on in the book, there's a man run out of the tomb who will be naked and his skin will be thrashed by little stones in the Roman whips, who will take upon all the evil upon himself, Jesus Christ, Son of God, who would die for our sins. This is how Jesus destroys evil. He takes all that destructive power onto himself. And it kills him. And he conquers it as he rises from the dead. That is the kind of God of the Bible. That is the Savior of the Bible. That's the kind of spirit and attitude that he calls his followers to have. That this Jesus would take all the destructive power that you and I have and take it upon himself on the cross. So yeah, if you have some issues or plight, you can go to doctors and get some medicine, go to psychologists and get some great counseling or treatments, you know, maybe assess, you know, think back through your life. Have I hurt someone? I'm just sort of traumatized by it. I haven't admitted. The guilt's eating my hand, you know, destroying me. Yeah. Or it could be that the challenges in your life are either partly or even inextricably interwoven due to the fact that demonic forces have a hand in your life, even if you're a Christian. You're just leaning into something that God is, that you think is from God, maybe. But you realize it's not from God. You know why? Because it's enslaving you. It's ensnaring you. It's pulling you away from people, from Him. And how is Jesus going to handle that? Well, He did on the cross. And no medicine, psychology, psychiatry, no counseling, no amount of confession will do. Only the power of Jesus dying for you and me. So what do we see? First of all, that demonic forces, we need to believe in them. They are real. Maybe more real than we think. Not just sort of the sort of scary shaman witch doctor thing that you might hear in missionary stories, though they happen here and overseas. But in anything that you have power in, that very same thing that gives you power and success and accolades and maybe identity is going to be used to enslave you. And if you try to give up, people will be like, "You're crazy." But Jesus can defeat that. And he has by taking the evil upon himself. So what do? Well, we get the title of our sermon. We don't follow Jesus. As we take a look here at verse 18. Please look. "As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with demons begged him that he might be with him." Now there are two important textual things you need to know about this passage. First of all, when he says, as he was getting into the boat, if you remember back in chapter 5, verse 1, this whole story began with Jesus, the words in the Greek, getting out of the boat. And now the story, the author Mark is artfully closing the story as Jesus is getting back into the boat, kind of bookending this. The man says, he wants to be with him. And we've run across that phrase, be with him, earlier in this gospel, chapter 3, where Jesus goes on a mountain and summons 12 men to be with him. So most commentators would say that this guy wants to become part of Jesus' traveling band, part of one of the 12 apostles. He wants to follow him. And Jesus says, no, you're not going to follow me. What does he say? Please look at Jesus' words in verse 19. And he did not permit him. Now notice, he permitted the demons. He permitted the demons, but he did not permit this man, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you, and now he has had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis, or 10-city region, how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. Sometimes we're called to follow, like Minister Peter. Go to the missions field, tell people abroad and other places what Jesus has done. And sometimes you say, God, you've totally changed me and saved my life. I will go anywhere. Jesus says, go home. Go home. Go home because you're the only believer in your immediate family. Go home because you're the only Christians in your extended family. Go home because your neighborhood needs someone to tell them. Go home. Go back to your regular jobs because your colleagues, your coworkers, your classmates, people in your grad program or school, whatever it is. Go there. Go home. And not shove the gospel down the throat. Not like be in their face. Tell them what the Lord has done for you. It means actually not saying to your coworker, say, hey, one of these days you should come to church with me. One of these days we should talk about, I'd love to hear about your background in faith. It means actually saying, can we have lunch or coffee? This is something that we've been friends a long time at work or school, and I just never shared this with you. I just want to share it with you because I'm excited and happy about it. God has freed me from this. And just tell them. And just continue to let God have the results and do, we just scatter the seed and tell people what God has done. Because if you are a Christian, then the question for us to consider is this. When was the last time you actually sat down and told someone who did not go to church, did not believe in Jesus or the Bible, what God has done for you? I'm not saying argue them against creation evolution. I'm not saying argue against atheism, theism, although you could have lively discussions in a loving, respectful way. But he's saying, go tell them what God has done. That's all Jesus is asking in this passage. Just tell them. Share with them. It's like when you go get a good restaurant. I found this great restaurant. I just want to tell with you. Cool. I just had this great experience. I saw this great movie. I heard this great song. Great. Why do we do that with restaurants and movies and songs? And we forget sometimes to say, I just had this great encounter with God. And people need to hear of a great God who has mercy upon them. They need to know. And if you are a Christian, if you're not a Christian, you're here. I have to think you're here because someone, somewhere on the line must have told you. Because God, in his inscrutable wisdom, has ordained that the way people hear about Jesus is from other people. Whether through a blog, a website, email, a book, or whether just talking on the train, or at the office, or at the coffee machine, or the water cooler. It's about telling someone. What has God done for you? If you are in the midst of something that you realize, there's more to this going on. It's not just physiological. Cry out to God. Because if it's a supernatural root of your problem, it requires supernatural resources. No pill, no counseling, no therapy will fix those things. Only the power of Christ on the cross. Let's bow our heads and pray.